Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
First, a new report says that the second largest group of foreign fighters for the Islamic State are from former Russian-held Central Asian nations. Christopher Jones Cruz has more.
Russian-speaking militants are the second largest group of foreigners fighting for the Islamic State militant group. Nearly 5,000 fighters from the Central Asian countries of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan have joined IS, according to the Sufan group. The largest number of IS fighters, more than 6,000, came from Tunisia, Sufan said. Sufan provides intelligence services to governments and businesses. The Russian-speaking fighters are among the Islamic State's most brutal fighters. Some are part of the IS leadership. They have settled mostly near the Syrian city of Raqqa, where IS has made its capital. Many brought their wives and children. They are raising their children to be future militant fighters, sources told VOA. While their customs, race, and ethnic background differ, these fighters have one thing in common. They can read and write Cyrillic script. Cyrillic is the writing system used in Russia, which controlled the now-independent Central Asian nations for decades. In their homes in IS-controlled Syria, residents can hear Friday prayers in Russian. Children study math and the Quran at a Russian-language school. Products from their home countries are sold at a Univermag Russian store. The men are experienced fighters, according to Salem Al-Hamoud. He is a civic activist from the IS-controlled Syrian city of Deir Azor. He now lives in Turkey. These fighters are very different from others in terms of discipline and military training compared to their Arab and African counterparts, Al-Hamoud said. Some fought for Georgia in the 2008 war against Russia. Given their combat experience, fighters from the North Caucasus are regarded as particularly strong fighters, said Edward Lemon. He is a researcher at the University of Exeter in Britain. Some were drawn to the Islamic State by lack of jobs in their former Central Asian communities or in Russia. Babajan Karabayev is a former IS fighter who returned to Tajikistan. Karabayev was unhappy when he could not find work in Russia. Karabayev received money from IS, but he said he left the group because he was not as committed as other fighters. Many of the Russian-speaking fighters come from migrant worker communities in Russia. Noah Tucker is managing director of Registan.net, a website focused on Central Asia. He said Islamic State does a good job convincing Central Asian Muslims that their problems could be solved by joining the militant group. He said IS tells potential recruits, "You are Muslims, and your problems are caused by those who oppress Muslims." Some experts said Russia encouraged militants to travel to Syria. Tucker said the Russian Air Force was able to bomb the Russian-speaking fighters in Syria with a level of impunity not possible in Central Asia. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Next, we hear from John Russell on how an economic slowdown in China has increased the number of Chinese travelers around the world.
Over the past 5 years, the number of Chinese travelers has grown to 120 million people. 1 in 10 international travelers is from China. New airports and better infrastructure have made travel easier for Chinese citizens. Young Chinese citizens are benefiting from reduced visa restrictions around the world. James Roy, a business analyst at China Market Research Group, said Chinese travelers are going to many more destinations than they did in the past. You know, in the past, where it was more about buying an expensive watch or a bag and showing that off, now it's much more about sharing on social media all of the exotic places that you've been to, Roy said. The World Travel and Tourism Council says that the number of Chinese tourists grew by 53% in 2015. Last year, travelers from China spent $215 billion outside the country. The increased spending on tourism outside of China comes at a time when Chinese officials are dealing with a slowing economy at home. Exports fell 20% in February, leading to fears of domestic job losses. Concerns about the economy have not stopped Chinese travelers. Instead, concerns about the economy may encourage Chinese to look for investments abroad. Wolfgang Arlt, the director of China Outbound Tourism Research Institute in Hamburg, said China's growing investments make trips abroad necessary. First of all, it's not all about leisure. There is an increasing part of outbound tourism which is simply business tourism, as China is investing overseas and as China has a lot of trading relations and business relations overseas, Arlt said. Some countries have benefited from tourism from China. Iceland, a popular destination for Chinese tourists, saw its tourism industry grow by 19% in 2015. Japan had 37% growth in visitor spending. The growth in the number of Chinese travelers is contributing to the global growth of the tourism sector, which has added 7.2 million jobs worldwide. Mark Tanner, the managing director of the marketing agency China Skinny, said as Chinese tourists travel in their own country, many will look for new experiences in other parts of the world. They are getting a little more adventurous and going a little further afield, and I think that is the same with domestic tourism. they may whet their appetite with some of the local destinations and increasingly travel abroad, he said.
China recently approved its first comprehensive law on charities and non-profit organizations. The legislation makes it easier for charities to register and provides protections for people who donate. It also provides stronger government supervision of the organizations. Carla Simon is an American expert on civil society in China. She said there are two sides to the measure.
There are two sides. One is the charities come into being more easily. That's the charity side, and that it, you know, they're permitted to directly register, and then the other, and more of them are. It applies to a broad range of charities. But the other side is, how do we protect the people who give money?
Lawmakers approved the new law at the yearly meeting of China's National People's Congress. The meeting ended Wednesday. Some people consider the law a government attempt to increase charitable giving. Donations stopped growing in 2011 when the media reported about the misuse of charity monies. The Britain-based Charities Aid Foundation recently rated charitable giving in 145 countries. It placed China second to the bottom. The legislation places a limit on yearly management fees. Charities are required to spend a certain amount of money they make. They can spend 70% of the amount given them that year, or 70% of the average income over the last 3 years. The law also provides tax reductions for people who donate. Chinese President Xi Jinping has pushed for greater control of civil society groups in China. The nation is considering a measure to place foreign non-profit organizations under the jurisdiction of the police. The new charity law says that charities found to be threatening to national security will be punished. Officials might cancel their registrations, for example. Chinese police have arrested many human rights activists over the last 4 years, reportedly for national security reasons. Patrick Poon is a China researcher for Amnesty International.
In China, the definition of what it means by endangering national security would be very broad, and then also really subject to the authorities' interpretation.
Supporters say the charity legislation is aimed at strengthening approved civil society groups. This would permit non-profit groups to help the government deal with the needs of the poor as China's economy slows. They say it will also permit China's new middle and upper classes to more easily donate to approved charities. Anthony Spires is a civil society scholar at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He said implementation of the legislation will be important to its effect on Chinese society.
It's going to come down to whether or not it's fully implemented at the local level. It's going to come down to whether or not Ministry of Civil Affairs officials at the local levels adopt a broad definition of charity or a very narrow specific one.
Spires said local officials
probably will understand the law in a way that excludes organizations working on politically sensitive issues, such as women's or gay rights. The Chinese government has said it wants to end poverty in China within 4 years, and the new law is an attempt to reach that goal. I'm Mario Ritter.
Next, Bruce Alpert brings us a report on how Chinese and United States citizens view each other.
U.S. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping met this week over international security issues. While they report slow progress over major disagreements, what do average citizens in those countries think about each other? A study by the Pew Research Center offers some answers. Only 38% of Americans said they have a positive view of China, according to a 2015 Pew survey. And in China, only 44% of people surveyed gave the United States a positive rating. Americans expressed concern about the large amount of U.S. debt held by China and the loss of jobs to China. Last year, the U.S. Treasury Department said China held $1.2 trillion in U.S. government debts. People polled in China said they believe the United States is trying to prevent China from becoming as powerful as the U.S. The views reflect some of the tensions between the nation's leaders. The United States has opposed China's construction of artificial islands and military facilities along the disputed South China Sea. And there have been disagreements over how to respond to recent North Korean nuclear and missile tests. A joint statement from U.S. and China after Thursday's Obama-Xi meeting said both countries agreed to work together on nuclear security. The Obama administration said China has agreed to sanctions to protest recent North Korean nuclear tests. But Xi expressed opposition to a new missile defense system for South Korea, according to Chinese media reports. Such a system is being considered by U.S. and South Korean leaders to protect South Korea from a North Korean attack. At the start of his meeting with Xi, Obama said, "Of great importance to both of us is North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons, which threatens the security and stability of the region." Xi said China and the United States have a responsibility to work together. As for issues dividing the two nations, Xi said both sides could seek active solutions through dialogue and consultation. The two leaders met during a 53-nation conference on nuclear security in Washington, D.C. I'm Bruce Alpert.
Next, Dan Friedel tells us all about the latest trends in automobiles on display at the New York Auto Show.
SUVs, or sports utility vehicles, are very popular with Americans. The large vehicle is part truck and part car. Strength and size combined with comfort. Some well-known sports utility vehicles are the Jeep Cherokee, the Cadillac Escalade, and the Toyota Land Cruiser. About 170,000 of those vehicles sell each year in the U.S. If you owned one of those cars, it would cost almost $100 to fill the tank when gas was most expensive. But these days, gas is cheap, and cars can go further while using the same amount of fuel. Some SUVs have hybrid engines, meaning they use battery power and stored energy along with gas to help move the car. Automakers like General Motors and Volvo think drivers in the U.S. might be more willing to consider larger vehicles again. At the New York International Auto Show, these car makers were showing off big SUVs with all sorts of nice components. Uwe Ellinghaus is the chief marketing officer for Cadillac. He says people think the XT5 SUV looks great. And even though it is large, it only uses a little more gas than a traditional sedan-style car.
Due to lightweight technologies, the weight of these SUVs is no longer so different to a sedan as it was in the past.
Stephanie Brinley is an auto analyst for the research company IHS. She says traditional cars will only save 1 or 2 miles per gallon, about 3.75 liters, compared to new SUVs.
The delta between a sedan and a comparably sized SUV for fuel economy or crossover utility for fuel economy is 1 or 2 miles to the gallon. It's not that strong. So even if gas prices do come up again, it's still a manageable penalty.
Lincoln Motor Company is part of the Ford Motor Company. Its president called the market for SUVs in the U.S. red hot. SUVs also sell well in China and the Middle East. Another kind of car is a crossover. That means it has some elements of an SUV and some elements of a regular car. It is somewhere in the middle. Brinley says she thinks the crossovers are popular because they allow the driver to sit higher than in a traditional sedan. Rob Peterson of Buick, a General Motors brand, says crossovers offer the best of both worlds. The ability to carry lots of people or cargo, but easy to drive like a car. One of these cars on display was a Lincoln Navigator. It is a large SUV. You walk up 3 steps to get to the door. Also, it has gullwing doors, or doors that flip up rather than out, that you might find on a fancy sports car. The famous car from the Back to the Future movies had gullwing doors. Whether they go for small, large, or crossover SUVs, this year, U.S. consumers will have plenty to choose from. I'm Dan Friedel.
É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É o resto de toco, é pouco sozinho. É caco de vidro, é a vida, é o sol. É a noite, é a morte, é o laço, é o anzol. É peroba do campo,
é o nó da madeira.
Next, Ann Ball reports on a possible cure for AIDS in this week's Science in the News report.
Since the start of the deadly AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, scientists have been working towards a cure. Now they may be close to finding one. Researchers have developed a method to cut the viral DNA from a person's infected cells. It is called CRISPR-Cas9, and it means the person could be virus-free. DNA is a substance that carries genetic information in the cells of animals and plants. This gene editing took place in a scientific lab, but has not been tested on humans yet. It's a big step, said Kamal Khalili, Ph.D. He is lead researcher and chair of the Department of Neuroscience at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He and his team made the discovery. But more tests have to be done to know if it will be a cure for the millions of patients infected with the HIV virus, which causes AIDS. Antiretroviral drugs have been doing a good job of keeping the AIDS virus from reproducing. Such a good job that levels of HIV are just about undetectable in infected people who take the medicine. But even with the drugs, the virus stays in the body's T cells, which are T lymphocytes. AIDS damages the immune system, hurting the body's ability to fight off disease. So the drugs are a kind of band-aid solution, Khalili explained. They keep the virus from growing, but they do not eliminate the memory of the virus from the cells. And the moment antiretroviral drugs are stopped, the HIV comes back to life and begins making more HIV, which is the AIDS virus. Khalili and his team of scientists appear to have found a way to cut this viral DNA from infected people's cells. In their lab, they took cells from people infected with the HIV virus. They removed the part of the cell that was holding the virus. He said they had, in some cases, near 90% of the virus replication or production dropped in the patient's samples after treatment in the laboratory. Khalili and his team have not actually cured any patients yet. However, he believes this gene editing technology could possibly cure AIDS. Elimination of the virus can lead to the cure. He said, "It's an exciting time, and the reason is the technologies are available and the methods are in place and our knowledge has increased. And hopefully there will be funding to take us toward this exciting moment for developing the cure strategy by eliminating viral DNA using editing techniques." He said that he hopes human tests could begin in 2 to 3 years, but that depends on funding. The work was published in the journal Scientific Reports. HIV/AIDS has been a devastating disease since it was first discovered in the early 1980s. Since then, the World Health Organization says almost 78 million people have been infected with the HIV virus. About 39 million people have died of HIV/AIDS. At the end of 2013, 35 million people worldwide were living with HIV, according to the WHO. Sub-Saharan Africa is the most affected by the virus. Nearly 71% of the people in the world who live with HIV are in sub-Saharan Africa. And while the drug therapy can control the virus, not everyone infected can get or afford it. Also, some who take it report side effects. I'm Ann Ball.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.